This is an ABC podcast.
Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Support businesses are going to go to the wall just like dairy farmers will.
We've seen the whole agricultural community come out.
Once people leave communities, they generally don't return.
Countrywide.
Don't worry about me, go and speak to your farmers.
We're already losing businesses.
Get out there and speak to your farmers today. And your gumboots on.
Countrywide, the politics of food and farming on ABC Radio.
Hello, Courtney Fowler with you on Countrywide. I'll be taking you through for the next half an hour. Thanks for your company. Well, over the years, there's been a battle brewing across the Trans-Tasman ditch over the New Zealand honey industry's attempts to trademark the term Manuka honey, which is, of course, famous for its valuable health properties. Well, this week, there's been a bit of a development in that case as Australian beekeepers fight for their right to use the words Manuka in their products.
So it's kind of like if a group of farmers came from Spain and said, we want to trademark Merino wool because Merino wool is a Spanish word, you know, or French wine producers saying that no one else can use Chardonnay because that's a French word. It's a precedent in being able to use a descriptive term to give somebody ownership of an industry.
Also in this episode of Countrywide, you're going to meet a high school student with a passion for livestock who's catering to a growing demand for a trending backyard pet, which may surprise you.
It started off in 2017 when my grandparents bought me a crossbred goat for Christmas. Then we got them pregnant the next year. Yeah, it just kept growing and growing and growing every year. And now, yeah, people are locked down looking for pets and yeah, they're looking for Australian miniature babies.
And in just a moment, we're going to hear more about a new Australian lamb record set at the Wagga Wagga sale yards. Just how high did those prices go? You'll find out more very shortly. But up first today, it's no secret the global pandemic has put international shipping under significant pressure. But as freight costs continue to soar, Australian farmers and exporters are struggling to keep up. According to the National Farmers Federation, the average freight costs for exporters has jumped 6 times over the past 18 months. NFF Chief Economist Ash Saladini says if sea freight costs continue to go through the roof, Aussie agriculture runs the risk of becoming uncompetitive.
It's the actual perfect storm at the moment. So stevedoring costs, shipping costs, and there's port congestion as well. So what that actually means for the average freight user is that costs have gone up by 5 to 6 times in the space of, let's say, 18 months. So that'd be the equivalent of a Big Mac going from $6 or $7 to about $35.
Okay, so what are the implications for exporters, first of all?
So from a farming perspective, we export 75% of our goods. And at the moment, we already pay some of the highest costs for freight. So it costs the same to ship a container of grain from Canada to Indonesia as it does from South Australia, despite it being some 10,000 kilometres shorter. So this spiralling of costs means that we might become less internationally competitive over the short term and potentially the long term as well.
So who's actually paying this extra cost at the moment?
In the end, consumers and growers will have to pay that extra cost, but everyone is paying for it. So freight forwarders are paying for it, consumers are paying for it, and producers are paying for it as well. So in the end, we will all have to pay for it.
Can we talk about the container shortage? Where are the containers? Surely they haven't just disappeared.
No. So the container shortage is basically a byproduct of, first of all, the COVID lockdowns, particularly in China. So a lot of containers ended up in places where they shouldn't have remained. So they ended up in Europe and in the North America when China closed their factories to get on top of COVID. And ever since we've been playing catch up. So there are enough containers in the world. It's just they're all in the wrong places at the moment. And it takes 6 to 8 weeks to get a container to where it needs to be. So we've been playing catch up ever since. And the Evergrande calamity as well added to that sort of crisis as well, where shipping was disrupted for 2 to 3 weeks with the Suez Canal being down as well. So there's increasing demand, but some of the issue has been that we've had lockdowns around the world and all the shipping containers are in the wrong places.
Are we seeing a lot of empty shipping containers moving around the world? Is that normal, or because that seems to be so inefficient?
It is quite normal in the end to move empty containers, but what we're struggling is to actually keep the empty containers in Australia so we can fill them. So Australia is not a major market for shippers. So what they're doing is as soon as they find an empty, they're shipping it to Asian and North American routes. So in terms of priority, Australia is not a high priority for shipping. So we are probably the collateral damage in this shipping container shortage.
What's the solution? How do you fix a problem like this?
Well, the shipping container problem, probably the solution is a global solution of looking at supply and working with our colleagues internationally to ensure that the supply gets to where the demand is. So that's not a short-term solution. But the cost blowouts is more than just containers. So international shipping costs have gone up 4 to 5 times. There is extra demand, but also we believe that there's a bit of anti-competitive behaviour by the shippers. The other area is around stevedoring. So at the moment, stevedoring costs are going under the radar, but there are two problems with that. One, stevedoring costs have gone up 4 to 5 fold in less than 4 years. The other issue is that all the IR disruptions and other disruptions have actually increased the cost of shipping. So freight users are paying $400 to $500 surcharges for shipping because there's congestion, and that congestion is basically caused by disruptions in the stevedoring supply chain.
Ash Saladini from the National Farmers Federation. He was speaking with National Rural reporter Kath Sullivan. A New South Wales-based export company, Fletcher International, says it's felt the pain of rising sea freight costs firsthand. Chilled meat has been left on the wharves and gone to waste, and there's been delays to skins and grain exports, according to owner Roger Fletcher. He says container rates have gone up to 5 times higher than they were earlier this year.
We've had a lot of effect because we also own our own trains and we get a lot of grains and lupins and things that goes to the port, plus all our meat and wool and sheepskin. So it has a huge effect on us. It's, we've got the problems around the world with COVID in a lot of ports where products have been put off the ports and then takes a long time to get back onto feeder ships, and massive problems in America, where there's ships been tied up for a long time. But saying all that, that's something that we were, Australia was going to cop, and our costs have gone through the roof. But
how much have your costs gone through the roof? Because we talked about container prices doubling and doubling again.
Oh, well, it depends which country you go to, but some of them's gone from 2 times to 5 times dearer. So that's depends where you're going and where you want to go. It's a very difficult one, and a lot of containers today out of Australia goes to a central port, and then feeder ships are charging a lot of money, and that's what's making it very difficult, especially on our grains and meat. It's caused a huge bottleneck for us on chilled meat. Australia's got a big trade in high-class chilled meat to a lot of countries, and when the wharves get cut back and we can't get it off the wharves, it's a massive cost.
So that's chilled. I imagine it's okay if there's a delay, or are you losing product?
Oh, no, we're losing it because it's all got expiry dates, and it runs out of expiry date, and then you've got to freeze it down, and it's massive loss. But that's not the real problem. We're letting our customers down. The way for Australia to grow businesses is look after your customer.
Well, are you losing market share then?
Yes, we're probably losing market share to other commodities, not meat. It goes, people prefer to buy something else. It's no point in real terms of saying, we're going to have hams for Christmas and the hams turn up in January. It's not much point, is there?
No. Now, we're just hearing some signals from, say, the US-China route that rates might be coming down. Are you seeing those signals at all?
Well, I think there will be a time when all of us will change because consumers now, they've spent their money on buying household things, and they haven't been going on holidays, they haven't gone to theatres, they haven't gone to races. That's worldwide. That's not just going into America, but Europe's the same, Australia's the same. And, that time will touch that round where people will want to change and go on holidays again.
That might not be too far off. But what about the strike action? Is that affecting you, or the costs are increasing from the stevedores?
The strike action's a real headache for us because it clogs our wharves, our ships go backwards, and we prepare meat for a ship and then it doesn't turn up on time. And that's a massive issue. And, you know, I just think for the good of Australia, you know, the stevedores and the unions got to come together and sort it out. I mean, it's also the shipping companies have got to build more ships, more containers. The wharves got to sort themselves out. COVID's been a massive problem on ports all over the world.
Roger Fletcher from Fletcher's International speaking with the Country Hour's David Claughton. And you might be interested to know that the ACCC says it has the continuing investigation into whether anti-competitive conduct has led to price increases in the container transport industry. There are calls, though, for government assistance to help reduce sea freight costs for exporters. In a statement to the ABC, Trade Minister Dan Tehan says he's asked both DFAT and Austrade to convene a series of roundtables with exporters, peak bodies, port owners and shipping lines to discuss some of these issues relating to the cost of shipping and explore what adjustments could be made to policy and regulatory settings. You can read more about this story online. Just head to the ABC Rural website.
From the paddock to the plate, countrywide on ABC Radio.
Sticking with the sheep industry for just a moment, and the Australian lamb record was broken at Wagga Wagga on Thursday, with a pen of 77 white Suffolk heavy lambs selling for $399.20 a head, beating the $380 price tag paid in Ballarat earlier this year. The 11 to 12-month-old lambs were bred by father and son team Eric and Ashley Douglas from Kayakora, which is near Nagri, and they were bought by Dubbo processor Fletcher's International, who we heard from a little earlier in the program. Wagga agent James Tierney says overall the heavy lamb market was very strong, despite some major buyers not operating due to COVID-19.
The market was a very good market all over, in particular for heavy lambs, as it's been the case actually for the last 3 or 4 weeks. Weight's a bit hard to find, and the market was very, very strong, particularly for heavy lambs, and these lambs were exceptional.
How did it compare to other prices? Was anything close today? And how does it compare to the previous Australian record for heavy lambs?
There was another pen earlier made 380. I'm pretty sure nothing else has made 390 ever. So obviously it's eclipsed that fairly well. But look, they were outstanding lambs, and they've hit the market at the right time. And there seems to be a big, big demand for export lamb.
What do you think's driving that export demand at the moment?
Well, what I'm told, demand is pretty good on the other end. Obviously, there's a few interferences here and there with COVID having a bit of an impact on, and probably that's the most positive thing of today. There was a couple of major players actually not operating due to COVID. Exporters, and for it to stay as strong as it did was incredible, really, in the middle of October. So there's a lot to look forward to, really, I reckon, with this lamb job. I still think we'll see some sort of correction as we get into the back end of the spring and the Victorian numbers run a little bit, but it's, certainly a good time to have sheep and lamb.
Wagga agent James Tierney there, speaking to reporter Olivia Carver.
What's on your dinner plate? Countrywide, the politics of food and farming.
You're with Courtney Fowler and ABC Radio. Thanks for joining me today. A new front has opened up this week in the long-running trans-Tasman battle over Manuka honey. New Zealand's Manuka producers have made several unsuccessful attempts to trademark the words in overseas markets, including right here in Australia. But now Australian producers are formally opposing an attempt to register the words Manuka honey in New Zealand. Australian Manuka Honey Association's Paul Callender says it's important to keep the name freely available in both countries.
The hearings about a group of commercial producers in New Zealand trying to get a certification trademark over a common descriptive term, which is Manuka Honey. The AMHA, the Australian Manuka Honey Association, is opposed to this because we believe it's wrong in both law and principle. Trademarks can't be used to give producers in one country a monopoly over a common descriptive term. And honey is the name of the product, and Manuka is the plant that it comes from. And so it's kind of like if a group of farmers came from Spain and said, we want to trademark Merino wool because Merino wool is a Spanish word, you know, or French wine producer saying that no one else can use Chardonnay because that's a French word. It's a precedent in being able to use a descriptive term to give somebody ownership of an industry.
Where else does the New Zealand Manuka Appellation Society have these applications? I understand that they were not successful in Australia.
They haven't been successful anywhere, Clint. They've tried in the US, they've tried in the UK, they've tried in China. They've been rejected in every jurisdiction so far. The problem is the New Zealand government is funding this and they just keep appealing and applying again. And so this is the first time the AMHA has opposed this certification trademark. So the hearing was the first time we've actually produced evidence that says the leptospermum is native to both Australia and New Zealand. And the anglicised word Manuka has been used in Australia for well over a century to describe leptospermum, which is the plant the honey comes from. And the term Manuka honey has been used in Australia since 1930.
The Federal Trade Minister, Dan Tehan, wanted both sides to hammer their issues out at a summit or a workshop. That was an idea floated in April. Did that ever take place?
No. And we've been trying to collaborate with New Zealand on this for 4 years. We've been trying to engage with every different part of that industry. We have two senior Maori board members who also agree with our position and have tried to engage in New Zealand with API and Z and others to talk through and discuss how we'd set global standards and scientific measurements and approach the markets together. We've been rebuffed every single time. So while I respect Minister Tehan's position, I don't see any reason that the Kiwis would collaborate when their government is funding a certification trademark. I don't believe in the short term that's a strategy that'll work. I think the government needs to stand up and say, you got a one-way trade on honey. This is going to seriously impact all of our beekeepers, and we just don't think it's legitimate for a group of people to try and monopolise an industry over a certification trademark.
Are you disappointed in the lack of support from the federal government?
We've been trying to get their support for 4 years, Clint, and so far nothing material has come out of that. So I'll leave that to your own conclusion.
What is the size of the industry? You know, how much is at stake here?
The Kiwis have, the Ministry of Primary Industry in New Zealand's got the market for Manuka honey at about $1.2 billion by 2027. The issue is, and Australia is about a third of that market, we believe, today. But it's not just about the honey, Clint. This is medically active ingredient in the honey called methylglyoxal. Methylglyoxal has been proven to fight superbugs. So it's FDA approved to go into intensive care units to fight superbugs as a natural science-based product. So the value of the industry extends way beyond just honey. It goes into pharmacy, cosmetics, and medical applications, wounds, burns, scars, possible pain management, anti-inflammatory. So there's all kinds of industries that this will have an impact on if we were to lose that ability to sell Manuka.
And you'd essentially be left trying to create a new name and market a new name for what is essentially the same product.
Yeah, and I've been across to the US and the European Union and presented as the AMHA, and they've told us that they stand behind us in terms of us being able to use the word Manuka. And there's no right to or reason to go back and rebrand it, because to rebrand a product like Manuka globally to a consumer, it takes millions and millions of dollars, and it would take 10 years to go back and start again to get products onto a retail space and educate the consumer. So it's not an alternative. The Kiwis know that, and we're not going to give up on the use of the word Manuka. We acknowledge that the word Manuka is derived from the Te Reo Maori word Manuka with a macron over the A, and we respect that, and we will never use that word. We spell it without a macron and have always done so.
The Australian Manuka Honey Association's Paul Callender speaking there with Clint Jasper.
You're listening to Countrywide, across Australia and around the world on ABC Radio.
Heading to Tasmania now, where big irrigation developments are prompting generational farmers to transform dryland merino sheep operations. The Tasmanian government has approved the business case for one of the biggest irrigation schemes in the past decade. It will pump out 25,000 megalitres of water across the Northern Midlands, a region known for its livestock and wool producing. Luke Radford has this story.
Yeah, well, they've always tinkered with water. We've always dry years wanted more water, and ancestors have tried flood irrigation and other forms. We've got a couple of dams and a flood take licence, but that doesn't allow us to water when it's really important, it's the dry times.
For eight generations, George Gatenby's family have farmed at the eastern end of the Isis Valley in Tasmania's northern Midlands. And like many farming families in the region, their livelihoods were built on the back of merino wool. But in recent years, he's made use of that limited irrigation to add a cropping rotation.
About 5 years ago, we were looking at a fully merino operation, and now we have about a 200-hectare cropping component, and that's predominantly under irrigation, and that's sort of a threefold increase on gross revenue.
Like his ancestors, George dreamed of what could be possible if they had access to a reliable water supply, and this week it became a reality.
Well, a big commitment of support from the Tasmanian government in the business case, backing in the Northern Midlands Irrigation Scheme, which has been supersized.
That's Tasmanian Primary Industries Minister Guy Barnett. And as he mentioned there, the state government has approved the business case for the Northern Midlands Irrigation Scheme. And it's set to be one of the largest and most expensive schemes in the state's history.
So altogether, it's a $147 million project. So about $70 million from the feds, $40 million from the state, and 37-odd million from the farmers. So it'll deliver huge opportunity into the Northern Midlands and agriculture in Tasmania. This is hugely important. About nearly 10% of Tasmania's agricultural land delivers more than 50% of our agricultural production. So that's because of access to reliable water. Water is liquid gold. It's delivering already in Tasmania because we've got 16 irrigation schemes across the state. And this will just be another one, but it's a very, very substantial one with even more opportunity in addition to what we've announced today.
So it's big, it's expensive, and it's promising to transform a region known for dryland cropping and livestock production into a food bowl capable of supporting intensive cropping and even fruit production. It sounds too good to be true. So how's it going to work, and where's the water going to come from? Sitting a kilometre above sea level in Tasmania's central plateau lies the Great Lake. At 176 square kilometres, it's a formidable body of water, and every day, enormous volumes of the stuff flow down through pipes to the Powhatina hydroelectric power station. From there, it's discharged into a tunnel called the Tail Race, which eventually flows back into the Macquarie River. And that's where the scheme will begin, as the CEO of Tasmanian Irrigation, Andrew Kneebone, explains.
It's going to take water from the Powhatina Tail Race all the way up to Parana and Epping Forest, down through Campbelltown to Ross. What we'll be doing is we'll be building off the tail race, we'll be building a buffer storage dam. From there, we'll pump it from there into a pipeline scheme that runs all the way through that area that we discussed. Some of that will be dual 1 metre pipeline. So it's a very large investment in pipe. It's a very large scheme by our, probably the largest in capital value that we will have constructed.
Is it the largest in terms of water as well?
In terms of summer entitlements, yes. The Midlands scheme, the existing Midlands scheme, has got a capacity of 30,000 megalitres, but that's over a whole year. This is just 25,500 just in summer.
On a personal level, access to reliable irrigation is going to massively benefit George Gatenby's business, but he also believes it's the type of change that's going to support the region he calls home for the foreseeable future.
It allows us to provide more employment, to invest in more infrastructure and make us more efficient, but even across the neighbours and every other grower across the total scheme, if you look at a threefold increase in gross revenue, that really puts a safety net on the whole community in the area, that there's going to be employment and there's going to be an industry in the future. The changes we've seen in 3 to 5 years and what we'll see in the next 5 to 10, it's going to be a completely different landscape where it's changed how we're going to see agriculture, it's going to see what we're going to grow, it's going to change how we look at agriculture and our investments we make.
Tasmanian farmer George Gatenby finishing that report on the Northern Midlands Irrigation Scheme by Luke Radford. The federal government has indicated it will fund the proposal ahead of discussion in Canberra over the final approval. Construction is expected to begin this time next year and be completed by the start of the 2024 irrigation season.
From the top end to Tassie, Countrywide on ABC Radio.
Finishing up in southwest Victoria, where a high school student has turned a passion for livestock into a growing business by picking up on a trending pet. In addition to his studies, the Year 11 student from Kooriemungal has tapped into the market of breeding miniature goats, as Jane McNaughton reports.
When Charlie Pousty received a unique gift a few years ago, he had no idea where it would lead.
It started off in 2017 when my grandparents bought me a crossbred goat for Christmas.
He was 13 at the time and had always wanted a miniature goat. And once he had one of his own, he decided to invest in a breeding pair.
Then we got them pregnant the next year and then, yeah, just kept growing and growing and growing every year. And now, yeah, we have a few running around now.
A lot of time and attention is required when caring for his herd of more than 20 goats. And that's in addition to his school responsibilities.
There's a lot to care for goats, especially now in keeding season. Feeding, watering every day, obviously, and then because we're just coming out of the cooler months, worms are around, so drenching them, worming and hoof trimming, like to keep them nice and trim now that we're coming out soon, yeah. It's very hard, but I just try to time it as best as possible. Like after school, I'll do all the goat stuff and then homework at night, as well as working. I've got 5 jobs, so it's pretty hectic, but I manage it all.
Miniature goat popularity is on a steady rise in Australia. It is now estimated there are over 10,000 miniature goats in Australian backyards.
People are locked down looking for pets and yeah, they're looking for Australian miniature babies. A lot of families with younger children are buying the wethers as pets, obviously.
Miniature goats sell for around $500 as pets, but breeders are willing to pay Charlie over $2,000 for a prized female goat. His proud mum, Mandy, says all parents should let their children dive into their passions.
So the business is really interesting. It has been fueled by his passion. So we have no expertise in goats whatsoever. He is fully self-driven.
She says that Charlie's miniature goat business is setting him up for the future.
So not only his self-confidence has evolved, his business management, of course, all organisational skills, budgeting, monitoring, assessing, planning, it's all developed, and Charlie has really, self-driven, it's been him driving it the whole time. I think it's the foundation of something a lot bigger. I think what he has achieved and the skills he now has enabled him to set himself up for the big wide world, and he's capable of anything now.
To progress his business, Charlie is looking at alternative methods of breeding.
So far we've done natural breeding, 2 different sires. We have taken AI into consideration, but just not yet. But we are hoping next year to start a synchronisation breeding program, which means they'll all be inserted with a seeder on the one day, and then in the next 5 months, they should all kid on the same day, hopefully, because at the moment we've got a few 5 weeks old and then some that aren't even born yet. So it's a lot of stuffing around for me that's at school. So yeah, we're hoping to have them all born on the same day or hopefully week at least, yeah.
That'll be a big day, a week.
It will, but yeah, it'll be very worth it, I think, because it's a lot of trial and error at the moment.
Charlie Pousty, owner of Curry Creek Miniature Goats, ending that report by Jane McNaughton. And that's it for this week's episode of Countrywide. For more of any of the stories you've heard in this episode, and to listen to the Countrywide podcast, just head along to the ABC Rural website. Until next time, I'm Courtney Fowler. Thanks for your company.
This is an ABC podcast.